minutes to 4 o'clock, and you're listening to Fresh Air on WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. My name's Danny Miller. I'm sitting in this week, and of course you can hear All Things Considered every evening at 5 o'clock on WHYY. Tonight on All Things Considered, a report on what's at stake this weekend in Iceland. Arms control is expected to be a major topic in talks between President Reagan and Soviet leader Gorbachev. NPR's Jim Engel and Neil Conan will report. Also, a report on parents, an interview with parents who paddled their 2-year-old son to death. They'll speak with Noah Adams. And Terry Gross will speak with Richard Price. Richard Price is the author of the screenplay of the new Martin Scorsese film, The Color of Money, which is a sequel to The Hustler. All that coming up tonight on All Things Considered at 5 o'clock on WHYY-FM. In a few minutes, I'll speak with best-selling novelist Anne Rice, author of Interview with the Vampire and The Vampire Lestat. From the novelty record Cutout Bin, we've just sampled Sounds to Make You Shiver in blood-curdling stereo. In a few minutes, I'll speak with best-selling novelist Anne Rice, who has written 2 vampire novels in an ongoing series called The Chronicles of the Vampires. In a New York Times book review, Nina Auerbach wrote, "The vampires whose hungers Anne Rice chronicles are not the conventional undead. They are truly alive." Her first novel, The Wonderful Interview with the Vampire, is narrated by a tormented Victorian aesthete named Louis, who is scourged and glorified by his heightened vampire perceptions. Louis and his kind thirst to know the mystery of their origins as insatiably as they thirst for blood. They brood over the death of God and the unenlightenment of the average vampire. Crucifixes and garlic do not trouble them, but changing times are their bane. Weary of endless adjustments to new centuries, they fall at last into suicidal inertia. Anne Rice brings a fresh and powerful imagination to the staples of vampire lore. She makes well-worn coffins and the crucifixes tell new tales that compose a chillingly original myth. The Vampire Lestat is Anne Rice's sequel to Interview with the Vampire. Lestat, the vampire hero of the book, rises after decades of vampire hibernation underground to become a rock superstar, forming his own band, hoping to attract the attention of other vampires he has lost contact with over the centuries. The Vampire Lestat has just been published in paper by Ballantine Books. Anne Rice's previous vampire novel, Interview with the Vampire, is now available as an audio cassette read by F. Murray Abraham. Before we speak with Anne Rice, let's listen to this excerpt of Interview with the Vampire, in which the narrator Louis describes how he was turned into a vampire by the older, powerful vampire, Lestat.
"Now listen to me, Louis," Lestat said, and he lay down beside me on the steps. "I am going to drain you now to the very threshold of death, and I want you to be quiet, so quiet that you can almost hear the flow of blood through your veins, and that same blood through mine. It is your consciousness, your will, which must keep you alive." I wanted to struggle, but he held me in check and sank his teeth into my neck. "Keep your eyes wide," Lestat whispered to me, his lips moving against my neck. I remember that the movement of his lips raised the hair all over my body, sent a shock of sensation through my body that was not unlike the pleasure of passion. I felt his teeth withdraw with such a keenness that the 2 puncture wounds seemed enormous, lined with pain. And now he bent over my helpless head and bit his own wrist. The blood flowed down upon my shirt and coat, and I think that I knew what he meant to do as if I'd been waiting for years. He pressed his bleeding wrist to my mouth, said firmly, "Louis, drink." And I drank, experiencing for the first time since infancy the special pleasure of sucking nourishment. The body focused with the mind upon one vital source.
F. Murray Abraham, reading from Anne Rice's Interview with the Vampire, available from Random House Audiobooks. Anne Rice is with me now on Fresh Air. Her most recent book in her Chronicles of the Vampires is The Vampire Lestat, which has just been published in paperback. Anne Rice is also the author of four erotic novels under the pseudonyms of A.N. Roquelaure and Anne Rampling. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You were born in New Orleans, and I'm wondering if that has anything to do with your interest in vampires.
Well, it must, simply because New Orleans is a city with such an incredibly gothic and romantic atmosphere to it. It's a city of dozens of haunted houses, and I grew up reading ghost stories that was set, you know, in those houses, and I used to even go and stand in front of the houses. And I do remember consciously feeling this was the perfect place to set the vampire novel as I started it. I didn't think too much about what I was doing. I was just writing along, you know. But I thought, this is the place, you know, Louisiana, the swamps, the plantation houses, that kind of thing. The atmosphere seemed right.
Did vampire lore there cross-fertilize with interest in voodoo at all?
No, not... I never found any active vampire myths about New Orleans itself, and I really myself didn't read too much voodoo lore. I think voodoo is still pretty much a mystery to most white people in New Orleans, and probably now to most black people as well.
Did your Catholic upbringing give you any type of vocabulary of ideas or images or rituals that you've incorporated into your vampire writing?
I think it's all through there. I mean, it's just, I can't get away from it. I mean, we were Catholics of the old fashioned kind. We still had the Latin Mass. We had the liturgy. We went to Mass and Communion every morning, and we worshipped in two enormous churches that had been built by the Irish immigrants and the German immigrants, side by side, practically. And I find that all kinds of symbolism and images turn up in my writing that come from that. There's something about the Holy Communion imagery. This is my body, this is my blood. I use it over and over again, particularly in an erotic context. And I don't mean to blaspheme or show disrespect, but for me, all of this is connected.
Just for the purposes of clarification, could you explain your beliefs about the existence of vampires? I mean, do you believe in vampires or in vampire lore? How do you – what's your perspective?
No, I don't believe in vampires. I really don't. What I enjoy about this, the thing that keeps turning me on about it, is the vampire for me is this wonderful metaphor for the outsider. And of course, as a writer, I want to write a completely convincing vampire story too. I want my fiction to work on all those levels. I kind of believe in what Aristotle said about the drama, that it should have plot, character, spectacle, you know, all of those wonderful and interesting people, you know, great characters. That I want all that in my fiction, but no, I don't. I can tell you, though, that I've been recently reading in the occult, and I've been getting more and more interested in people's accounts of apparitions and out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences, and of entities that seem to communicate through mediums and through Ouija boards and things like this. I think there's a great deal there that needs to be explored very seriously, and I'm getting less and less skeptical. But vampires, no.
What are the themes of the vampire as a metaphor for outsiders that you're interested in investigating?
He seems to me to be the archetypal outsider. He looks just like us, but he's not one of us. He usually, in my novels and in other people's fiction, he moves right through society. He's right in the middle of everything, yet he's completely set apart. He can put his arms around the living. He can kiss them. He can make love to them, but he can never really be part of them. All he can do, really, is drink their blood. And he has to do it over and over again. It never takes. You know, he has to go out every night and get the essence of life from somebody who's living. I mean... And it's really, I think, an image for a lot of people who feel in their hearts that they are in the middle of all this and everyone else is singing and dancing, but they're not singing and dancing. And I would even go so far as to say that many people feel like monsters. There are ways in which they feel monstrous, or they feel maimed, or they feel seriously spiritually and physically disfigured, you know, and they know they're not rationally, but this is a deep feeling. And when I'm writing about the vampires, I know that I'm talking about all of that, though I don't consciously try to do it.
Who are the outsiders that populate our real life that most interest you?
Oh, the rock stars is one example. I'm fascinated by all people that are right in the middle of it and yet not part of it. And I think the rock stars are just glittering monsters at this point. That's why I'm so eager to see a rock biography that really goes into it deeply. You know, I've let it be known that I would like to co-author that if somebody is ready to. But, I mean, really get into it so that somebody 500 years from now can read that book and know what it was like to be that kind of a celebrity. You know, a paid outcast. A paid out guest.
Yeah, that's just so interesting because you certainly don't think of somebody with that type of celebrity and public focus as being an outsider at all.
Oh, they are. I mean, you know, I've heard many stories, we've all heard them, about people like Michael Jackson can't really go out in public at all. They can't. You know, I remember hearing one story from a reporter that had interviewed a famous rock star, and she said they were sitting in a theater together, and pretty soon people began to pass notes, and then they started coming down the aisle and looking in the row, and finally, she and the rock star had to get up and get out of there as fast as possible before there was an actual, you know, endangering disturbance. So, but that's just part of how they're monsters.
Well, for the purposes of clarification, then it's established that that you don't believe in vampires.
Right.
But in terms of the vampire story and vampire lore, I'd be real interested in just picking your brains, so to speak, to find out just what the lore is. Mm-hmm. For instance, how does somebody become a vampire?
There are two different sort of theories on that, according to the literature and the real superstitions. In Eastern Europe, where the people do actively believe in vampires and still go through a lot of magical rituals to prevent people from becoming vampires, they believe, I think, that anybody whose blood is drunk is going to become one. I mean, the idea is sort of that if, say, you die and you're not in the state of grace and they bury you in the village churchyard, well, you undergo a very dangerous period, according to their religion, the Eastern varieties of the Catholic Church, because they believe the soul doesn't leave the body till it decays. And during that time, the devil can get that soul. And so, say you were a real bad guy and you committed suicide, you know, that's the worst. You're very likely to lose your soul during that period and to come back. And the symptom will be that suddenly everybody in your family will start wasting away. And there's clear proof that you're coming in the night, you know, and that you're sucking the blood of those that were closest to you. That's the popular belief. That's really, you know, the active belief that exists. What the genius of the writers who first wrote about vampires was they took that belief and they created aristocrats and made them vampires. The peasants never believed the local lord was the vampire. You know, that didn't occur to them. There were a couple of real bad guys like Gilles de Rais and a Countess Barthelme that bathed in blood. But, you know, they weren't enough in themselves to create a whole mythos. But the great talent of Stoker and Sheridan Le Fanu and even Dr. Polidori, who wrote the first vampire story in English, was to make an aristocrat this leech. And, of course, this happened right at the time in European history when the aristocracy had lost its power and really was leech-like to the public. It was right after the French Revolution. But to get back to it, in my books, you don't become a vampire unless somebody chooses to make you one. And that's really what happens in Dracula, too. Dracula has to make an individual a vampire. Every victim does not become one.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of complex interrelationships going on between the vampires and lots of intent and sometimes really guarded type of relationships between your vampires and your novels, it seems.
Oh, really? Well, I think one of the themes that runs through all supernatural fiction is that deals with immortals is if you're immortal, you're going to be horribly lonely. So you're going to seek for someone to share your existence with you. But one of the things I like about the vampire material is I don't believe that vampires would have really erotic contact with other vampires. I think the kill would be the erotic contact, and that would happen with mortals. So what happens is something very heightened and emotional and cerebral with the other vampires.
What are the beliefs about what type of powers vampires have?
They're generally perceived as being very, very strong, preternaturally strong, if not supernaturally strong. And being able to control animals, being able to put people in a spell, hypnotize them, and so forth. I go along with all of that. I found those wonderful devices to use in the novel. I don't go along with the magic things, like being able to change into a bat or a dog and so forth. And I think that Bram Stoker got into a lot of trouble with that in Dracula. He has this great scene where Dracula climbs down the side of his castle, face down. Why would anyone do that who can turn into a bat, you know?
Are there favorite sources of victims for vampires in your novels or in the other classic novels?
In Dracula, clearly, it's Mina and Lucy whom he... Well, actually, when it just comes to his victims, I don't know who in London he goes after. But, I mean, Mina and Lucy are his prey in terms of turning them into vampires. In my book, one of the ideas I enjoyed exploring was that different vampires like different kinds of kills. Lestat, whom I see as my hero, my real hero, you know, the man who seeks to be truly heroic and good in spite of being a vampire, preys only on criminals and evildoers because he finds that that's the easiest way to exist with this curse. And Marius, another vampire in the book, the ancient vampire that Lestat finds, the one who's been alive since Roman times, he feeds only on the evildoer.
There seems to be a almost like a code of honor not to prey on the innocent for Lestat. I just found that interesting.
Exactly. But now for Gabrielle, his mother, it's quite the opposite. It's absolutely of no consequence to her. It does not matter what the person is. She simply says she has no interest in mortal life or humans. She takes the blood and then she turns her eyes toward the stars or the trees or the mountains and the rocks, which I think some people would do. I think that's exactly the way they would use eternity if they had it, at least for a couple of hundred years, you know.
Well, since vampires don't die, they accumulate the knowledge of the centuries that they live through.
Some of them do.
Some of them do die?
Or no, some of them don't. I mean, some of them accumulate that knowledge. Others don't, you know.
Some of the vampires in your book, I have the sense that they're bringing their old world sensibilities and experiences into the 20th century mm-hmm. and trying to adjust.
Right.
Yeah, what were you playing with with that idea?
Well, with Lestat, I was playing with the idea that I'd used in the earlier book, that you can't really take the passage of time, that eventually it'll drive you mad, especially if you live right in the middle of things, that you'll eventually just go bananas. Just seeing the transition from the carriage to the railroad train to the jet plane would be a bit much. But that what they do, finally, is they go underground for periods of time and they reemerge. That's something he discovers early on. And then Marius later confirms that that's exactly what they do, that that's the only way to live is to live in cycles. That's the only way to survive. But some of the vampires in the book don't change at all. They isolate themselves in covens and they live underground. And they actually have almost a religious attitude toward avoiding everything that has to do with current fashion or worldly pleasure. And they're really ascetic about the whole thing, like saints. Armand is the example of this in the Vampire Lestat. And I meant him to, in some ways, represent all of the old ways of Europe, the Catholic Church in particular, the changelessness of the religious orders that was still teaching and wearing elaborate habits and wimples when I was a child.
One of the themes that that I think you explore in your books is just this whole idea of almost the curse of eternal existence.
Mm-hmm.
One of your vampires said, I think it's Armand, that you know, eventually, sometimes it happens that a vampire realizes that there's nothing left to live for except for killing,
mm-hmm.
And that you know, next to being able to get fresh blood, the most important thing to a vampire is the will to go on.
That's right.
The most important thing to his or her survival.
Mm-hmm.
Have you thought much about the curse of eternal existence yourself? It's such an interesting idea that you.
I am basically an extremely optimistic person. And I'm not in any way cynical. I think, as you can tell from these novels, I keep condemning those who are cynical and those who don't see that, you know, the glory in simple things and the timelessness of beauty. And so my sympathies lie with the characters who do survive the passage of time and are able to stand it and don't go mad. And it's a great challenge to me and will be a great challenge in the next book to describe further the mentality of somebody like Marius, who's supposed to be a child of the millennia because he survived well over 1,000 years, almost 2,000. But I do think it would be a curse in many instances. I think it would be awful. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's almost inconceivable to us. If you look at the other examples of books where people have dealt with it, there's a terrible poverty of imagination. It's almost impossible to conceive of what the wisdom would be. I mean, look at Aisha by H. Rider Haggard. You know, that's a famous novel about an immortal woman, and she's supposed to be just consummately evil, you know, and she really doesn't seem to know very much, you know. I mean, over and over again, immortals are presented like that. They're presented as to be almost menaces. Well, if they're not vampires, they're menacing in some other way, you know, because we're offended by the idea that they're still around, that they're taking up more space and air and everything else than they were ever entitled to. And in fact, I think we even feel that way toward very old people, or at least some people do. There's a resentment, a horror. And I think it's unfortunate, because I think it would be, in many ways, a beautiful thing to be able to live and to be released from the body and still be able to witness the passage of time and to see all the wonderful things that are going to unfold. And I put those words practically into Marius's mouth, you know. But in practical terms, I think it could be a horrible thing.
My guest is Anne Rice, and her most recent book in her set of Vampire Chronicles is The Vampire Lestat, which has just been published in paperback. You mentioned a moment ago that that Lestat rises from the underground after going through a cycle of kind of like vampire hibernation. Could you just explain the process of awakening for him, how he revived himself?
Yes. Well, my theory is that if he stops drinking blood, he becomes very, very weak. And so the last thing he did with his strength was bury himself deep in the ground. And then he withered away practically to a skeleton, you know, wrapped in sort of parchment flesh. And what awakened him was, as he says, amplified voices. He began to hear the voices of radios and televisions, which had barely begun to speak when he went underground. It was a little, but not very much. And then electronically amplified rock music is what woke him. And as the cliche goes, that music could wake the dead, you know. Excuse me. So he began to work his way to the surface. And the way he did it was by grasping very tiny little creatures in the earth that had some sort of blood in them and then getting enough strength to get up above ground. And once he was up, then he could feed on the rats and the cats and things like this until he was strong enough to take a mortal. And he waited till an evildoer came by, you know, a long time. And then finally there was a killer there. And with Lestat, it's also an aesthetic thing to want to kill killers. He wants that power, that terrific intensity, that evil, you know. And so he finally, you know, jumped one of these people and then got the strength to come out. And then he went to seek that rock band and to find out what that was about and to take a hard look at the 20th century and see what was going on. And he found it to be an absolutely beautiful time where there was no place for a mythical monster like him or shall we say a magical monster like him. And I meant those pages very literally and sincerely, where he describes the 20th century in glowing terms. It was very much misunderstood. I found many reviewers said, we're living only in a time that only a vampire could love, and so forth and so on. But I never meant it that way. I really do think these are wonderful times. And there we have seen the end of a lot of things on Earth that nobody foresaw the end of before. I mean, we really are fighting to wipe out war and poverty. And we are making medical strides to wipe out the pain of sickness and death, if not the literal things themselves. And I think this is true. If you read history as I've read it, if you really immerse yourself in the 18th century and the 19th century memoirs and letters and so forth, you really realize how good we are. I mean, I hate to say it, but we have done many things. I mean, we're very down on ourselves. We don't see ourselves in perspective sometimes. The very people that work so hard to make us good often don't realize how far we've come and what we've done. And I wouldn't want them to stop work, but I think sometimes they could be a little proud of themselves for caring about so many things.
Well, your character, Lestat, I think one of the things he really enjoys about waking up to the 1980s is that almost the decadence is back in style again. He's remembering the joie de vivre of the aristocracy, of the old world. And you know, so when he sees people, women in miniskirts and flamboyant hairstyles and loud music and...
That's true, but see, to me, that's not decadence. It's really an ability to enjoy life in a certain way, and I think we lost that when the revolutions began. I mean, just as he says, when the revolutions began, the revolutions that really changed the course of history were in the main middle-class revolutions. They were not proletarian. You know, they really weren't. I mean, the French Revolution was dominated by the middle class, and it really was. And what they brought to the fore were a lot of very middle class ideas about doing your job and going to the factory every day and doing what you were supposed to do. I mean, the Industrial Revolution was, you know, a middle class thing. Even Marxism, in a way, can be seen as a middle class body of ideas by a middle class man who really didn't know the proletariat too well. Maybe, you know, I mean, that's a big kettle of fish, but. And what he sees now is that the Industrial Revolution has run its course. And in the electronic age, which is now coming, once again, enjoying life and being a full individual in every sense is coming back into fashion. And you do see people dressing in bright colors again. You do see people caring about their environment in a new way. I mean, wanting it to be beautiful. I mean, to look at it, I mean, you could say that a lot of this originated in the 60s and 70s, that the Flower Children left us a legacy of, you know, brilliantly decorated restaurants and bars, if nothing else. I mean, you know, every surface seems to be more decorated than it was 30 years ago. But that's the way I saw this. This is a really important thing. Architects today try consciously to build new areas that are like the Piazza San Marco in the 18th century. I mean, they even speak of this, that they're bringing that European open piazza idea to America, and they've done it all over. And that's what he sees. And I see the same thing. And I think a lot of the grim forecasts we had about the future that were made by intellectuals and writers, like 1984, Orwell's novel. They were made during the darkest years, sort of the Industrial Revolution and the European wars that had so robbed intellectuals of hope and optimism during that time. And now we're seeing it's not like that. This is, we've had 1984. That's why I titled the chapter, you know, Downtown Saturday Night in the 20th Century, 1984, meaning, you know, it was not what Orwell foresaw. It really was not.
Can you remember what your inspiration was for making Lestat a rock star?
Well, as I said, I see them as outsiders. I see them as monsters. There's a theme that runs all the way through the book that Lestat is a sort of a Dionysian figure, that he's a god who celebrates the irrational and the wonderful power of just raw energy. From the time he's a young actor on the stage in these very vulgar boulevard theaters that operated in Paris at the time, so all the way to the rock stage. So I see that continuity. I mean, this is somebody who always wanted to be a performer and a singer and a show-off. And there are passages in An Interview with a Vampire about him quoting Shakespeare on the street and at passers-by and things like that, and dragging Claudia and Lewis to see Macbeth and, you know, that kind of thing. So to me, that all worked just of itself. And it tied in with the whole mythology of the book because the actors on the stage can be seen as representatives of the gods that once, you know, were worshipped in blood rituals and the dramas that were once worked out with the mother goddess and her lover, the vegetation god. It was all connected. It should, if it works, it should all echo. You know, there should be a feeling of completeness with all of those ideas. But I also thought, very simply, that it would be the perfect occupation for a vampire. Absolutely.
Did you use any group performers as models for?
I did, but I think you're going to be surprised. They're so old. I mean, I'm 45, so the Rolling Stones and the Doors. I mean, that's who I was thinking
of.
Oh,
no, no, that's really good.
Yeah, I'm not. I did go to several heavy metal concerts at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. I was probably the oldest person there, and I roamed around and watched everything that was happening and all of the details at his concerts of what I saw very recently in San Francisco at these large stadium-type rock affairs. You know, but really it was the sound of Jim Morrison singing L.A. Woman, The Doors. That's what I was trying to capture. That's what I was describing when Lestat gets up on the stage and does his song. That kind of phallic rock, I would call it, you know.
Yeah, it's not the literal devil image that contemporary heavy metal groups have, but I think that's really perfect. That,
mm-hmm.
What do you think about the devil imagery of groups? I guess like maybe like Queen or other.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not up on it in detail, but offhand, I think rock musicians and the whole rock music thing is pretty wonderful because it enables kids and everybody else, kids of all ages, as they say, to work out all these destructive drives or potentially destructive drives, irrational drives, in a symbolic context without anybody really being hurt. And though parents seem to be extremely frightened about the lyrics and so forth and so on, I mean, if you think about it, there are concerts all over this country all the time, and people are not getting killed or hurt at these concerts, probably less than at football games or baseball games. I mean, at any time you bring people together and you have beer, I mean, somebody might be hurt. But we really have moved toward working out all these things symbolically. That's the nature of our century, that young men don't have to go to war to prove themselves. And for the first time, they're seriously considering that that might not be a noble thing to do at all. That's a really new idea under the sun. Really new.
There is a movement in this country now that we're concerned about rock lyrics, mm-hmm. the Parents Music Resource Center, and the religious right, you know, wondering both about the impact mm-hmm. of rock lyrics on drug use and so forth, but also in terms of devil worshiping. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if your books are ever thought to promote devil worship among their readers by the religious right, if you're ever criticized by mm-hmm. by conservative religious evangelists as promoting devil worship.
I have never heard that accusation. I know that the books are assigned in English classes all over the country for kids to write papers on, and every now and then they're assigned in philosophy classes. And I think what interests the teachers is that this is a book they can teach. You know, they can have the kids follow the main themes, and the philosophy is very clear, and there's a discussion there of good and evil. And they really seem to respond to that and the writing style, the fact that they're offering the kids something where everything's grammatically correct for once, you know, or written well or so forth. And this, to me, is the most wonderful thing in the world. I mean, nothing makes me happier than when somebody comes up and says, I read Interview with the Vampire in my honors English class, you know, or something. I love it because I don't know. I mean, it's just wonderful to have that audience, to have that appreciation. But no, I've never been attacked. I don't think anyone takes the set literally. You know, I really don't. Even I have fans that will show up at book signing parties dressed as vampires. But they're usually very sophisticated people, and they enjoy doing this. This is a gag. They'll present me with a bouquet of dead roses wrapped in black lace. You know, I've had that happen twice. And I mean, these people are in beautiful clothes, you know, black wool frock coats, gorgeous makeup. They'll have their faces all done up with white paint. They'll have beautiful hairdos. The women will be in long gowns. I mean, it's just wonderful. But it's all fun, you know. I mean, I'll give you an example. I have one fan. After he read Interview with the Vampire, he went to his dentist, and he had a pair of fangs made that fitted right here over the right teeth, you know, and they were exactly the same color as the rest of his teeth. And it was so realistic. I couldn't believe this. And he told me that he went all over Europe, you know, sort of pretending to be Lewis in Interview with the Vampire and brooding about the meaning of life and what was going on. This is a college student. I mean, he's a very sophisticated kid. And yet he can enjoy the fun of the fangs, you know, and yet all of the... He's written me just wonderful responses to the book, you know, said very intelligent things. So that's more what happens in relation to them. Nothing horrible has happened where anybody has taken it literally and misunderstood it, or not that I'm aware of.
My guest is Anne Rice, the author of Interview with the Vampire and The Vampire Lestat. And Interview with the Vampire has been reissued, and The Vampire Lestat is now out in paperback. You've said in interviews that you're interested in the people and practices of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what particularly interests you.
The people and practices of the 19th century?
Yeah. Here's a quote.
Well, yeah.
Sorry, I should have warned you that you had said that.
Yeah, no, I don't. I'm not sure what the context was, but I'm an avid reader of history. I mean, I'm always astonished at the things that I discover, from the fact that an expression like "the coast was clear" was common in the 18th century, or Broadway's "the thing" was common. You know, to say something was the thing was common in the middle of the 19th. I'm amazed by all of that. I'm always studying history to try to understand the way our minds are changing and the way that we're not changing, the way that we're the same. Like one thing that fascinates me is the fact that Lestat could read any book he saw today, even if he'd been underground since the 18th century. He could read the same English. I mean, Moll Flanders is perfectly understandable to most readers. So in that way, I'm very interested. I would say, though, that I'm only interested in these things as they bear on us today. You know, it's one reason why I've said all along about all my books that they're not really historical novels. They're not written to illuminate history. They're written to say something about what's happening now. And one reason that I've moved away from historical settings, except in the vampire novels, is I'm tired of arguing about that. I mean, it's so easy to be misunderstood when you write in an historical context.
Are there periods where interest in vampires was most rampant?
It seems that there was a real craze in Europe in the 18th century. And at that time, too, there was still burning witches in some places. It was pretty much over by 1750, but occasionally they were still executing a witch. And there were a couple of people who were arrested for being werewolves and confessed to unbelievable crimes as werewolves. I went out and changed into a wolf and ate five kids, you know, and all this sort of thing. And they were killed, executed in France and different places. And there was this sort of craze. And it's difficult to know, I mean, why that was or why that happened. Then, of course, it all passes into fiction and it passes onto the stage and so forth, and you have a tremendous interest in vampire literature. Like in the middle of the 19th century, there was a novel called Varney the Vampire or the Feast of Blood that was all the rage. I mean, this was a penny dreadful, as they called it, and everybody read this. And Melmoth the Wanderer was the bestseller of 1820. You know, it wasn't about vampires, but it was a horror novel, and horrible things happened in it. You know, and Melmoth was an eternal character. A damn soul that smiled at suffering and things of that kind. People have given all kinds of different theories as to why these things surfaced at that time. I'm not sure. One thing I see is that we always work into horror fiction whatever we work into anything else. You know, that if we were in the 60s when we were really concerned about kids taking dope, we had The Exorcist, you know, the late 60s. Or the early 70s, and all those movies about old people that did evil things, and Nanny and Baby Jane and stuff. And, you know, right at the time when the culture's changing so much and nobody knows what to do with old people, and people are living longer, and there's this frightening battle going on about these things. The vampire seems to never go out of style. I mean, he keeps coming back. I do think he was born as the aristocracy went out of fashion. I do think that that's what is behind the image for a lot of us, but I think there are even deeper echoes, that he echoes all the way back really to the lusty gods of ancient times.
Are there contemporary fears that you think play into present-day interest in vampires?
I'm not sure. I think it's more a universal and timeless fascination with the monstrosity of the creature, the combination of the seductiveness and the monstrosity. I think it's more that.
Can I mention something that it's a quote, and I think this should make sense out of context. But you wrote, "I know that much of my writing is concerned with problems of sexual identity." And I'm wondering how that affects the actions and the motions of your characters and the development of your stories.
Well, that is really getting into something so personal that I wonder if it even would interest readers. You know, I think that clearly my writing can be read as the work of a woman who was alienated from her femininity at some point, you know, so that she found it easier to write from a male point of view most of the time. Now, as I look back on it, I think that was something that didn't need to happen. If we didn't, if we didn't keep trying to define feminine sexuality and feminine sexual identity so narrowly, if we recognize the fact that there is an enormous range to it, perhaps much greater than the range to male sexuality, people like me wouldn't be driven to identify with males in order to express themselves. I mean, I am a woman, and I'm finally beginning to realize that my point of view, for better or for worse, is a feminine point of view, because that's what I am. And I have found a lot of other women who have a similar kind of energy and similar kind of hang-ups, to use the slang. And I think I'm writing now more and more from the point of view of women. I'm beginning to do it more naturally. But in the beginning, I think that I was so convinced that my intensity didn't really belong in a woman that it was easier for me to identify, particularly with a gay male, because there you had a male who was attracted to men as I was. So,
did you ever feel that it was a challenge to write from the perspective of male sexuality? Because now that you mention it, yes, in your vampire novels, that is definitely from the vantage of male sexuality.
I feel it's totally natural to me, you know. But again, I think that, I've had people have all kinds of reactions to it. I've been accused of having a masculine point of view, yet other people have said it's clearly the work of a woman and it's a feminine sensibility. So, you know, it's like what I seek when I write really is the universal perspective. That's what I seek. You know, the way that people transcend gender, the way they transcend all role models, finally, and seek to love or to have others as companions, regardless of their sex. And for some reason, and I really don't know why, when I'm alone in that room writing, you know, right at my computer or typewriter or whatever it happens to be, gender really doesn't exist for me in a practical sense. And I remember years ago, a Hollywood producer was talking about an interview with a vampire, and he said, "It isn't homosexuality, it's polymorphous sexuality." And I thought that was very interesting.
One book reviewer wrote about one of, I think it was about Interview with a Vampire. Vampire stories express social relations, almost entirely in sexual terms, except that the ultimate experience is not sex, but death. Is that something that you'd agree with?
No, I don't think so. I mean, clearly that's their relationship with mortals, but I'm always in my novels talking about friendship and intellectual relationships and the way that people, you know, the torment that love and the need for communication constantly create. One of the things that fascinates me, of course, is how a person like Lestat, a really action-prone, optimistic person, manages to live a good life in spite of being basically a damned creature. And in The Vampire Lestat, he has a sort of ongoing dialogue with a character named Nicholas, who really doesn't believe in Lestat's concept of goodness at all, and they have endless discussions about it. And that relationship is very important, and it's not defined either purely in erotic terms or at all, or terms of vampiric contact. I mean, they really have a relationship of the mind, and I can't really get too close to a character like Nicholas because I myself don't believe what Nicholas believed, but he was meant to be a very ironic, cynical person and who derived a lot of satisfaction from rebellion. And then, of course, when he becomes a vampire, he's absolutely destroyed. I mean, because he can't handle it. And that fascinated me. I liked working with that, you know, and that Lestat, the one who had a very clear conscience in the sense of having a very clear perspective on things, was able to survive the whole thing.
My guest is novelist Anne Rice. Her most recent vampire novel is The Vampire Lestat, which has just been released in paperback, and her previous vampire novel, Interview with the Vampire, has been re-released. Well, you have also written a number of erotic novels under the pseudonyms A.N. Roquelaure. Is that pronounced right?
Roquelaure. I barely know how to pronounce it myself.
and Anne Rampling.
Right.
Is there a clear, obvious link to you between those novels, your erotic writing, and your vampire novels?
Yes, there is. And I didn't set out to be an erotic writer. You know, it wasn't something I planned. But clearly, it's something that I am. And the A.N. Roquelaure books are pure erotica. That's really all they are.
Could you
define
that? They're
pornography.
Okay.
They're meant to sexually arouse you. I mean, that's what they're for. They're for sexual pleasure, and they're meant to be a delight. And they're sadomasochistic, but they're very tender and sort of safe. I mean, they're meant to be a safe fantasy for those who want to enjoy captivity and coercion, but not anybody getting really gruesomely hurt. There's no really horrible violence in them. And that's what they are. They're for people who want to enjoy that. And there are many people, apparently, who want very much to enjoy that. So they feel kind of guilty about it, I think, and there's not much written for them.
Is there any? Is there much of a story involved?
There is, but it's entirely secondary to the erotic scenes, whereas the books that I write as Anne Rampling, they're real novels. They have erotic themes. They deal with many of the same themes I deal with as Anne Rice, outsiders. Erotic outsiders, you know, people that are outside the mainstream. The real difference is that the Anne Rampling novels are contemporary. They're set now in the 1980s, and they're very upbeat and optimistic, and the characters usually manage to break into the mainstream. And why I can't do that as Anne Rice, I don't know. But the vampires never get into the mainstream, and the free people of color, the quadroons and mulattoes that I wrote about in Feast of All Saints, they never get into the mainstream, and neither do the castrati opera singers that I wrote about in Cry to Heaven. But in the Rampling novels, for some reason, these people are able to solve all their problems and transcend everything, and I love writing those novels. I mean, it's a really different personality to me and a different voice, but I'm very serious about them. The recent one, Belinda, that I did as Anne Rampling, I dedicated to myself. So that should say it, you know, how I feel about them.
In your novels written under the pseudonym A.N. Roquelaure, the ones that you described as pure erotica, are there genre conventions that you like to work with? What are they?
Well, I think erotic novels are very, very repetitive. I mean, you know, nobody could really be having all that sex. I mean, they would drop, you know. It's just too much. So I was even going to put a note in the first one about that, and the editor said it's not necessary. It's a convention of the genre. But that's really what they're all about. And I mean, that's one of the reasons I put them under a pseudonym. So I like working with the conventions, but the conventions are very limiting. But my idea was really that you wouldn't have to mark the really hot pages, that every page would be hot. So, you know, they can be really boring. If it's not your type of erotica, you're not going to like this book. You know, there's no reason to read it. There really isn't. At the same time, I'm very proud of this. It's an accomplishment. I feel we have very little, sincere erotica written by people that can write. I mean, Anais Nin has left us two books, A Delta of Venus and Little Birds, I believe, is the other one. It's very interesting stuff because there was somebody who was talented and she put down these things, these little stories and so forth. And then there's a great book, My Secret Life, by X from the Victorian age, and we don't know who wrote it. People have speculated Dickens did. I'm almost convinced Dickens did not write it, But anyway, I mean, these are valuable things, I think, when somebody does it. And I like to believe that years from now, somebody can read the Roquelaure trilogy and they'll have a picture of a certain kind of sexuality. And it will be very authentic, really, because it's true to the fantasies that all of those who enjoy sadomasochistic fantasies really share. You know, there's true to the ideas, true to the... I was really exploring it, you know. It was meant to be something more important than just a quick read. But at the same time, if it doesn't turn you on, don't bother with it. You know.
Well, you had mentioned that you wanted every page to be hot. Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense when you're writing this, the number of pages, which might be the typical portion of a typical reader in a typical sitting?
Actually, I have none. I just sit there and write it. And with all my books, I just write with, you know, the rhythm that has to do with the scene. As a matter of fact, you know, with Anne Rice, I get a little flack about the fact that a character will come along and tell a story that lasts 200 pages, you know, and then there'll be a story within the story, and somebody will say, "Do you realize you have Marius quoting the Elder, and it's Lestat quoting Marius?" I don't care, you know.
Did you get better at writing erotica after your first tries at it, do you think?
Oh, yeah.
What did you learn about how to write?
I don't know that there's that much difference between the first and the last book. In the last Roquelaure book, I had a character who was a lot like Lestat, who poked fun at what was happening. And that was sort of my transition out of the trilogy. You know, in the beginning, it was very serious. I mean, everybody was in the fantasy. But Laurent, this character in the last book, was sort of admitting up front how enjoyable all this was. He was one of the slaves in this mythical kingdom, and he was getting a huge kick out of it, you know. And when it was all over, he really didn't want to go home, you know. And it's a fairy tale world. There are princes and princesses, and they're serving a king and queen in this erotic kingdom with a promise that they'll be released to go home, and everybody does it. And it's, you know, and when he finds out that his father's died and he has to go home and be king, he's just furious, you know, that he'll never get to be a slave again. And now he has to, you know, take the reins of state. But I would have never put that in the first book. I would have never dared to let that little bit of humor come out. I should add, too, that a lot of sadomasochists have told me, you know, have given me response on the books, and they've, you know, when I do something that's physically impossible, they let me know. They forgive me because it's a fantasy, but they let me know. This is not safe, or that doesn't work. You know, I find that in the main, these people are hipped on safety. I mean, they're very concerned that things be hygienic and safe, and get on my case a little bit if I make a mistake.
How about the editing of your erotic books? What type of advice or editing do your editors give you?
I'm really just absolutely horrible when it comes to editing. I don't want to be messed with by anybody, you know, and I'm very resistant, and I argue, and I don't want... I now have a rule, really, across the board: do not write on my manuscript. Do not write a word on it. If you find something you don't think is clear, note it in the margin. But I really, and I was particularly concerned with this with the erotica, because I felt that for this thing to have merit, it had to have a stylistic purity, you know. I think writers have a terrible time with this question of editing. This is not, for me, a collaborative art form. And you wouldn't take Pavarotti or Marilyn Horn, you know, into a studio to make a record, and you wouldn't say, "Listen, Luciano, we're going to dub in another tenor in the places where we think your voice is thin, and it's going to make for a better sound." Nobody would dream of that, and nobody would want the record if they did do that. But editors do that to writers all the time. They scratch out your word and put in their word where they think it's better. And that, to me, is like dubbing in another voice. So I've sort of had war at one time or another with practically everybody I've worked with, and the erotic novels were no exceptions. I mean, the thing that I greatly admire about the editor of the erotica was the fact that he was so courageous. He was one of the few people in American mainstream publishing who would have done it, and he published the books beautifully.
Did you do any research for your erotic novels?
No, I really didn't. I'll tell you what I did do. I walked in the store and found there was nothing I wanted to read. You know, so I thought, if there's nothing I want to read, I'm going to write the book I want to read. And that's kind of what I did with Interview with the Vampire. That was really the idea, you know, to create the vampire novel that I'd always wanted to read and never been able to find.
Generally speaking, what type of writing is more profitable?
Oh, definitely Anne Rice, you know. I mean, anything I write is Anne Rice. My pseudonyms just don't have the same kind of circulation. I mean, you'll probably be able to find an Anne Rice book in any bookstore in the city, and you may not be able to find Roquelaure or Rampling. You know.
How important are reviews to the sale of erotic novels, and where are they reviewed?
Oh, almost not at all. I mean, erotica. Now, pure erotica, almost not at all. The only press that does these anymore that I know of is the gay press, because that's really the only underground press that's left. And they also review the vampire novels as well, because they've been perceived as gay allegories, which I'm very, you know, flattered and interested in that kind of interpretation. I think that's marvelous. But that's where they are. So it's not really important. I'm not sure reviews are too important to the sale of any book. It's a very strange situation that exists in America with reviews.
You had mentioned that it's very easy to buy an Anne Rice book, but tough to buy a book under your other pseudonyms.
Some places.
Where are the places that they're sold? Are they sold in, like, pornography shops?
No, not at all. Not at all. They wouldn't go over in X-rated stores. You know, they're too literary. But, no, you can find them in New York or San Francisco easily. It's just that there are many other places where they're just not that well known yet. You know, I mean, but Belinda is particularly a mainstream novel. You know.
Do you think there are differences between how men and women read erotica and what they find sexy?
I think women enjoy erotica much more than they enjoy X-rated movies. One of the few generalities about women's sexuality that I'm willing to accept is that women really aren't visually stimulated in the same way that men are. And I don't think they like watching the kind of crudery that goes on in an X-rated movie. I don't think it turns them on. But I do think that in the privacy of their own homes, they like to read erotic material. And women, of course, are one of the main, you know, audiences for books all over America. I mean, many more women than men read books. And I think that they like to receive information in that way.
Can you tell if, you know, in reading erotic literature, if the author is a man or a woman, or at least
no.
intending to be to write from a male or a female point of view?
No, I felt for a long time that the story of O was definitely written by a woman. And I remember people arguing with me vociferously saying, absolutely not, it was written by a man. No woman could have those fantasies. Well, that's nonsense. I mean, thousands, millions of women have those fantasies. So, and millions of men do, too. But I could be wrong. I mean, we've never really known who that person was who wrote the story of O. I mean, it was supposed to be a woman, and she was supposed to have been interviewed at one point. But it's still not, you know, there's no real proof. I mean, the person's never come out of the closet. So we don't know. I think if you're a really good writer, you should be able to make the reader forget altogether. You really should. And you should be able to go with the sensibility. I mean, you should be able to cross over. I do think it happens more often that women write as men than men writing as women.
What are your pseudonyms based on?
A-N just means Anne, the two initials spell Anne. And Roquelaure is a French word for cloak. And it was popular at the time that Lestat lived, and there is a scene in the novel where he steps out on the stage and drops the Roquelaure and frightens the audience. And that was a little joke of mine about my pseudonyms and my identity.
How about Rampling?
I just took it because I liked Charlotte Rampling in the movie The Night Porter. I thought that that was a very interesting movie that was underrated by people. And she was very interesting in that movie. And so I took the name Anne Rambling.
What did you like about The Night Porter?
You know, I wish I had seen it more recently. It's hard. I just remember that it dealt with kinky sex and it dealt with sadomasochism in what I considered to be an interesting way.
Yeah.
They had a terrible time with that film. They were banned in Italy. They ran into all kinds of problems. It was directed by a woman, which I'm not sure many people know. And I think Dirk Bogarde, who was in it, saw it as an anti-fascist film. And that's what it meant to them. I mean, they saw it as a really worthy effort, and it was much maligned and much misunderstood. It was very gripping to me. I found it more interesting, really, than Last Tango in Paris as a really quality film about the erotic sides of ourselves. But we don't get those films anymore, really. You know, it's just the X-rated film killed all that.
I think The Night Porter is beginning to enjoy something of a video cassette revival
mm-hmm,
now.
Probably, yeah.
What are the other films that have interested you, either erotic films or otherwise?
Well, I don't know. There are any number. Blade Runner for me and Alien are the archetypal horror movies. I think they're works of genius. That Ridley Scott is just an absolutely brilliant director. I mean, and Alien, well, not Alien, but Alien was the scariest movie I've ever seen. But Blade Runner was, to me, a masterpiece about the outsider. You know, these replicants that looked almost human. And, of course, it was right up my alley, so to speak. I mean, it was right about the very themes that I like to work with. So those films have had a real profound influence on me, I think, just in that I watch them over and over again. But I've also loved Apocalypse Now and Godfather 1 and 2. I thought those were brilliant films. And again, those, well, not Apocalypse Now, but the Godfather films are about a group of people in the midst of society who are totally outside it. And, it you know, about power and force and things like that that have. Now, when it comes to erotic films, I haven't found very many that I found interesting at all. The really disappointing thing about erotic films in America is that they so often end with literal violence and death. The American mind seems to need that. In fact, that's something of the subject of Belinda, my new book, that the American mind craves that and is going to make that connection, no matter what you do. They're going to connect sex and death. And we see that every night on television, really, that, you know, we'll see a cop show and it'll be about young prostitutes and the young prostitute will nearly get killed and the cop will rescue her at the last moment because there's something about the American mind that demands that that happens, that somebody who breaks the rule almost die or die. And so I've been disappointed over and over again by erotic films because of that. I mean, gay films for years always ended in suicide or murder. Always, you know. If there was a gay character, he died. Dynasty killed its gay character. Stephen's lover, you know, he got killed in Moldavia or something, you know, during the revolution last season or season before last, whatever. But it's terrible. I mean, one of the things that I want to do as Anne Rampling is keep ending these novels without anybody killing anybody. I think they'd sell a great deal more if somebody murdered somebody. And maybe the vampire novels do offer that conventional connection in their own symbolic way. Maybe I have to admit that that's the case.
The Mies Commission on Pornography, which concluded its work a few months ago, I think provoked a lot of discussion in the women's movement, amongst women on different sides of the issue of the merits of sexually explicit material and erotica versus the potential harm that that this material might present to women, or the demeaning material to women. What do you think about that? About that that distinction, and where do you find yourself in that argument or discussion?
Well, there are people who've studied it a lot more closely than I have. I am totally against censorship. I think the bill that was sponsored by Andrea Dworkin and Catherine MacKinnon was evil. I'm glad that it could not be passed and will probably never be passed. I think the idea that you can sue somebody for violating your civil rights because they make an erotic film about women and you don't like what happens to the women is absolutely outrageous. I think that is just inviting evil to come in the door. I mean, to think what that would do to artists of all kinds is just incredible. I can't believe that they proposed something that stupid and that they were taken seriously. And I think part of the reason they got away with it was that they were women and that they were feminists. I think if that had been proposed by two Bible Belt male ministers, it would have been laughed out of the public arena almost immediately. As for the Mies Commission itself, it did not prove to me that there's a real connection between pornography and violence. I mean, I think it's preposterous. I mean, they just have not proved it. I mean, millions of people every month read Playboy who do not go out and commit rape. I mean, it's, I mean, you don't outlaw the automobile because 54,000 people in a single year can die in traffic accidents. We no longer even attempt to outlaw alcohol, though hundreds of thousands of people die from it, you know, from alcohol-related accidents and death. You don't narcotize an entire area of the culture because a few people abuse the freedom that they have. And the freedom to write and to speak and to express yourself as an artist, in especially with the written word, I think is a sacred freedom. And it is worth the price of the few people that are going to abuse it. There is no freedom that is not going to be abused by someone. And the test of that freedom comes when somebody does something with that freedom that makes you really uncomfortable. You know, and you have to believe in it very, very firmly. Now, when it comes to things like the censorship of television, I'm confused by that. I don't really know quite what to think about that. There are a lot of regulations that already pertain to what can go into people's homes. But I'm for taking away all of it. I mean, I think we are so much more healthy now than we were in the 50s when a married couple had to be in twin beds in a movie. And we had some really filthy movies, as far as I'm concerned, that was so lecherous and slimy. I mean, sex was really presented as dirty in that day and age, and sensational. And now it's a lot healthier, really, to be able to see people in healthy love scenes in one bed on television.
Let me ask you about movies that hopefully will be made from your books. What's the status of that?
The Vampire Lestat has been bought for the movies, and it's in development now. Two brilliant producers that I like very, very much are producing it. There's talk of developing Interview with the Vampire for a Broadway play. The negotiations are still going on with that.
Now, have you contemplated about how the writer is traditionally treated on the movie set?
Oh, sure. I think that right now I'm in constant communication with a producer. It's a partnership between Mike Levy and Julia Phillips, and Julia is the one I talk to most often. And this is a brilliant, brilliant woman who made, she won the Oscar for The Sting, and she also produced with her husband, Michael Phillips, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Taxi Driver, Steel Yard Blues. I mean, she's brilliant. She's got great visions, but I know that there will come a point when I have to just withdraw. I mean, I don't want to write the screenplay now. You know, we know that I don't want to do that. And she has not asked me, and I don't want to do it.
Well, you're now also writing a third book.
Yes.
in your chronicles. What type of research are you doing for this third book?
I think the research is done at last. I might be able to get through it without any.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being on Fresh Air today. Sure. I'm sorry we're out of time.
Okay. It was a great pleasure. I enjoyed it a lot.
My guest has been Anne Rice, and her most recent book, The Vampire Lestat, has just been published in paperback by Ballantine Books. Her previous book, Interview with the Vampire, has also been reissued, and you can also hear Interview with the Vampire as part of the Random House audiobooks series. It's 2 minutes to 5 o'clock. At 5 o'clock, we'll hear tonight's edition of All Things Considered. You'll hear Terry Gross, guest co-hosting with Noah Adams tonight. I'll tell you what's coming up this weekend on the Best of Fresh Air and next week on Fresh Air after this word from Shadow Traffic.
On the Schuylkill eastbound, 40 minutes in traffic between Gladwin and City. Westbound, almost an hour delay. We're approaching Montgomery Drive out to Belmont. 95 north is jammed between Penn's Landing and Aramingo. Also slow traffic on southbound 95 heading toward the International Airport. In Philadelphia, an overturned car at 69th and Lindbergh, an accident at 53rd and Chestnut, and a car, or rather truck, has knocked down a pole on Delaware Avenue near Catherine. That's right in front of the heliport. Northbound of the Media Bypass, traffic is jammed there between Baltimore Pike and Route 320. In Middletown, Delaware County, an accident on Route 352 just south of Route 1, and traffic is jammed there. In Cheltenham, church is closed west of Washington Lane. And in New Jersey, up in Lawrence, Route 1 northbound is closed just north of the Route 1 alternate and overturned tractor trailer. That's Shadow Traffic, and I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM WHYY.
That Shadow Traffic was from Philadelphia Business Journal. Sunday at 6 o'clock, broadcast journalist Linda Ellerbe will be on the Best of Fresh Air. Monday at 3 o'clock, a documentary on Abdullah Ibrahim. And at 4 o'clock, author and illustrator Maurice Sendak will speak with Terry Gross. You're listening to Fresh Air on WHYY FM in Philadelphia. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.
From the earliest plans for the nation's capital to Louis Kahn's expressive modernism, Philadelphia has provided the nation and the world with designs of exceptional beauty and distinction. Now, the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts invites you to view more than 200 architectural drawings, which trace the vibrant artistic and historical heritage of Philadelphia's architects from colonial times to the present. This extraordinary new show, Drawing Toward Building, is appropriately mounted in Frank Furness's beautiful historic landmark building. Drawing Toward Building at the Academy of the Fine Arts, now through January 4th. The Academy is located at the corner of Broad and Cherry Streets in Philadelphia and is open until 7 every Wednesday evening. For further information, call 215-972-7600. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. This is Noah Adams.
And I'm Terry Gross with All Things Considered.
The president's vision of defensive systems may eventually die if he doesn't get this program going while he's still in office.
President Reagan is under increasing pressure by supporters of the Strategic Defense Initiative to deploy the missile system earlier than planned. Tonight on All Things Considered, SDI, moratorium or rapid deployment.
Also these stories, a last-minute deal between the White House and Congress breaks the spending bill impasse.
Intrigue surrounding a second plane owned by the same company that operated the downed Contra supply plane.
We update the story of Stonegate, a fundamentalist commune where one couple accidentally spanked their son to death while teaching obedience to God.
That and more coming up. Now we have this news.
I'm Frank Stachow. The President and Congress have reached agreement on nuclear testing and other arms control issues on the eve of the President's meeting with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev in Reykjavik, Iceland. NPR's Neil Conan has more.
The President will submit two treaties limiting nuclear testing to the Senate early next year, but unless there's an agreement with the Soviet Union on verification between now and then, there will also be a reservation attached that will delay ratification of the treaties until verification is agreed. White House Press Secretary Larry Speaks told reporters here that this compromise with Congress unties the President's hands to deal effectively with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev in their meetings this weekend. Speaks made it clear that any further reductions in testings would have to be in conjunction with cuts in nuclear weapons, and that the United States intends to continue nuclear tests as long as it has nuclear weapons. In addition, the deal with Congress includes a compromise on spending on the President's Strategic Defense Initiative. Speaks also announced this evening that President Reagan will address the...